Welcome to Raw Talk on M88. Call in with your questions or comments. Toll free 1-866-730-4921. Or submit your question to Dear DJ at M88.org. Now, it's time for some Raw Talk on M88.
And welcome to Raw Talk. Appreciate everyone joining us tonight. And just a quick reminder, the DJ Volleyball Tournament coming up July 10th. Still time to sign up for that. Just send an email, studio@m88.org. Let us know which DJ's team you'd like to play on. And we'll be gathering together July 10th, 6 p.m. For some time to hang out and fellowship. And on tonight's Raw Talk, I'm excited. We have a special guest in studio with us. We have Kurt Revay joining us, renowned. Can I say that? Is that okay to say? Renowned archaeologist who has made many very cool discoveries. And so we're going to talk about all the stuff that he's done. And Kurt, thank you so much for joining me on Raw Talk tonight.
It's an honor to be here.
Yeah. Why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself just so they can get familiar with who you are before we dive into some of the cool stuff that you've done.
Okay. I'm just a regular guy with a very irregular life. Originally, I was born as a Christian, and still am, but from Holland, okay, so typical Dutch guy near the sea, windmills and lighthouse, and grew up, of course, on the all the stories of the shipwrecks. The place I was born was called Den Helder. In Latin, it means door to hell, so it tells enough about how cruel the sea there really is. So all my life was about shipwrecks and cargoes that must be there, things like that. Even though I had an omen, you can say, one day when I was a small boy and was laying in the fields of gold there one day, and on my back and playing with the clouds, with, you know, see all kinds of faces in the clouds, everybody does in his life.
Yeah.
And suddenly there was this bird there hovering over me and chittering, and the light suddenly blinded in my face. Probably I've been looking too long to the sun. But I felt like somebody telling me from, oh boy, you're going to get a great life. You're going to see the world. You're going to have a magic life. I remember that from that moment I understood my life never would be the same. And lucky for me, it turned out to be death. Not that it was an easy one, but it certainly is an adventurous one. And as life developed, I found myself as in that naval town and fishing town that I grew up in, that Den Helder, the only university actually was, of course, connected with the sea, the Naval Academy. And after that, I ended up in the army, like conscription in those days. And I was chosen to be in the forces in the Dutch colonies in then those days, the South America, and the Caribbean and Guyana and so places like that. So I served as a jungle commando for many years in the Amazon itself. So that's enough adventure to fill a program.
Yeah, no kidding.
And even though my plans were always to immigrate in the end, because Holland was too small for me, that was for sure, but it was always Canada or America. First of all, Canada. My dream as a boy was always to be a Royal Mountain policeman.
That's really?
I loved horses. And
that's cool.
The funny thing is now I've been quite all over the world, but I still never have don't have that picture as a Royal Canadian policeman, even though at the age of 10 already volunteered when I fought the fight of my parents. I wrote them a letter, please take me, you know, and they were very nice, even answered. But that's the funny thing. That's one of the goals in life that I didn't realize yet. But in the end, I stayed in South America after the army, became flying in the flying business.
Mm-hmm.
And then life became kind of like if you have seen the movie with Gibson of Air America, that was the kind of life.
Yeah.
With some less shooting, but it was very, it was also very, very adventure, period with a lot of adventure.
Yeah.
On one of my occasional talks there with, I think it was with a soldier buddy, one day asked me there, in jungles, he asked me, why on the personal mark I put on my equipment is a Star of David.
Mm-hmm.
If I was Jewish, I said, I'm not Jewish, I'm a Christian. So why the Star of David? I said, well, first of all I saw that you guys took already every other existing symbol. That was the only one left. And I feel something sort of Shield of David. And okay, so we start talking, and he told me his dream was always to get one day to Israel. I said, okay, when you go, tell me, I come with you as a pilgrimage. And so we made a kind of vow, you know, but I don't know if it was serious in that moment, but we made a kind of vow. And as life continued, we met again in Holland, and then we went to Israel like every pilgrim. And then the Yom Kippur War broke out, and it was a very bad time for Israel, of course. And we volunteered. We stayed.
Wow.
In those days, was the Arab embargo, so all the countries that helped Israel wouldn't get oil. So only America gave weapons, and the Dutch people stood up against the oil embargo and sent volunteers, doctors, nurses, pilots, truck drivers, everything you can imagine, thousands of people. Many of them also stayed. So we volunteered for 3 weeks, and we're still there. I mean, it's 36 years late.
It's a long time to volunteer.
But the thing that really, I fell straight away in love with this beautiful but also a little crazy county, of course. It's like a surrealistic county. It can't be a thing like this. It's impossible, but it's making the impossible possible. But I became very much involved and found a beautiful house on the beach, which looks out on the Mediterranean and the palm trees everybody dreams of in Holland in the cold, rainy.
Yeah, right.
And the right side of my house, there are the ruins of Ancient Dor, which is the harbor city of King Solomon. And there's also a natural port. So as a hobby, actually, I started to venture out and start finding coins, finding pottery, finding that. And then I start snorkeling in the bays. I'm finding shipwrecks. And so archaeology became not only first a hobby and then a profession, it became actually an obsession for me. I mean, that's the reason why I stayed in Israel.
Yeah.
And because I was drafted in the army and I went to all the dirty battles that there were in the region. And I've seen also the other side of life there. And I'm lucky I'm still alive today. But the thing that really, I got so attached to every stone and every piece of history that I collected there, that became my heart and my soul, that country.
Very cool.
And so the archaeology became the key for everything. And I was very lucky. You know, in those days we were like the discovery. We were actually the first one that started with the underwater archaeology also. So I started the excavations actually there from Tel Dor, which is now a 26 years program already, which brings hundreds of American volunteers, American Canadian mainly, every year to Tel Dor to dig and even pay for it. I mean, they pay their own costs. So it's a very big, it's the largest ongoing, also from size and time running, excavation going in in that region, not only in Israel. And then I started the old ruin that was near the sea that became my base, became turned into a museum, with the Dor Museum of all the archaeology and the water archaeology. Then I became co-founder of all kinds of other projects, and we started even in university in the process of where you can study underwater archaeology and things like that. And I became involved in the diving world, started diving schools also for people, and these people became again our volunteers for our underwater excavations. And so tourism, everything, hotel, everything developed in a big way.
Wow.
But nobody actually planned anything. I mean, I was like in Shogun. I was planning next year go back to Holland.
Yeah.
But every time something else happened that kept me going.
That's cool.
So we became the pioneers in underwater archaeology. If you say pioneers, there were two other kibbutzniks, Ramban and Linder, which are not alive anymore, which started at the same time, a little bit before, and started founded also the university later. And Shelley Waxman was an immigrant from here. And me, we became the first underwater inspectors for the Department of Antiquities. Okay. And we became the first team to study Israel's maritime heritage.
Wow.
And what the people know about, of course, the biblical history of the Holy Land, and what everybody knows, the desert and Jerusalem, and the holiness of everything. But nobody knows, or knew, including us, that actually Israel is very much a maritime country with a history of at least 5,000 years of seafaring. If you say 5,000 years of seafaring, it means at least one ship would go down every year. There must be also some at least 5,000 shipwrecks over there. So this became very intriguing for us. And in the course of surveying the seabed, slowly we start finding one wreck, two wrecks, three wrecks, and it went on like that. So that even in our profession around the world became a very hot thing. I mean, it is fantastic. And not they're not shipwrecks like here or like in my native Holland from 300, 400 years, 500 years at the most. Boats like that, we don't even look at in our place. We need at least 2,000 years, yeah. 3,000 years. It's the ones that all those black pages in history that we can reconstruct the socioeconomic life around the Mediterranean in those days. So, in the Asian world. So, we were very lucky. We were really spoiled. And because I became so much involved, not only in maritime archaeology, also land archaeology. If you see Indiana Jones movie today, I'm just loving it. I mean, we
did. I was going to ask you about that. Like, how much of your life is like an Indiana Jones movie?
Yeah, so, usually when I'm in the media in our region, they always call me the Indiana Jones. not only archaeologist, you know, I've been in the flying and the diving in the jungles and the deserts and in the armies and all continents. So I have a very, 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 very life. But this is not a thing we haven't done yet. I mean, if you take, we have excavated Tells, these ancient cities, and not more than one everywhere. We've been digging ancient tombs. We've been diving into submarines for World War II with the skeleton crew still inside. We found treasures. Some of the biggest in the world. I mean, one of the treasures that we actually found in the 80s is still today. It's the largest ever of the Holy Land. It's one of the greater ones, underwater, ancient ones that we found. Just 20 meters from my house, you know, from the shore, two
really?
Meters deep, in the Carmel Coast there. We find these things, whatever you want. In that case, Napoleon's armor, but not on the same Carmel Coast, also about 20 meters offshore. And a few meters deep, we found this treasure. This treasure was something like 1,500 kilos of ancient coins.
Wow.
Together with about 3,800 artifacts, whatever you want, from little statues to candlesticks to silver decorated plates, everything you want. This is a Walt Disney type of thing. I brought with me pictures and films because nobody will believe
that. Well,
and most of it, there's a lot that we keep also quiet because in Israel, you know, it's the Middle East.
Yeah.
And robbing is, pirating is very, very common thing. And soon that comes in the news there. Here you can talk freely. There, the next day we have about 500 divers plundering the seabed.
Oh, my goodness.
So we have to be very careful with that. But so not only the coins, not only the artifacts. We found about 100 kilos of jewelry there, beautiful bracelets. And
how that. Much of this so, is from, like, the time of Solomon? Because it would seem to me that at the height of that time, when Solomon was doing a lot of trade all throughout the region, that there must have been a lot of ships helping with that trade.
Yeah, well, that's one of the riddles, you know. Mm-hmm. First of all, you always find something that you were not looking for.
Right.
That's the first thing. And the second is what usually is what's written. That's not what you're going to find in the water. Mm-hmm. There's always surprises. And it makes it only more interesting. But like from Solomon days, first of all, what we know from King Solomon, of course, that they used the cedar trees from Lebanon to build exactly shipwrecks. Wrecks, ships.
They got wrecked later.
Yeah. In the end, every ship will be in the sea bottom like we will be in the ground.
It's sooner or later.
Sooner or later. So, but there will be wrecks in the end. But the thing is that so far from the wrecks in the Mediterranean, we haven't found yet a wreck with cedar trees in it. This, the Galilee boat, yes, the planking is from cedar tree, but that's a lake boat. We talk about the seas. So far, we haven't found. So that's one of the riddles already. Like we never found a Phoenician ship, and the Phoenicians there were the great seafarers of the Mediterranean. Now, it can't be they never sunk a ship in 1,000 years. So we are at the beginning of 40 years in the profession. I mean, there are many hundreds of years to come, and thousands of shipwrecks still waiting. But so far from that information, we can't prove that yet. We didn't find some. Now, King Solomon is a complete different problem at the moment. As maybe you know, but there are some sources in archaeology at the moment, especially Tel Aviv University. They're trying to prove, they just can't prove that there was at all a King Solomon because we can't find archaeological evidence so far. Again, so far, the same like with the wood. You got, of course, everything that's written, but it's like, say, David. You got stamps on handles from pots from David. You got a city of David. You got occupation levels in everywhere. Mm-hmm. But that's missing from the times of King Solomon. So we have a problem here. So there are people said maybe King Solomon was like King Arthur, you know,
like a legendary
guy. So for this, it's very important now that we're going to find something feasible that belongs to that time. To my luck, if we talk already about King Solomon, that and certainly in my place, you know, that is even written in Kings that there was even an Israelite king, Ben Abinadab, who was married to one of the daughters of King Solomon, Tafat. So the place I'm living actually and mainly researching at the moment, that should be one of the places that we must find something from that period, if it's possible.
You know, everyone talks about King Solomon's mines and those movies that are made, become like a legend.
Everything is a legend, but archaeological proof is another thing. Okay, right. The same thing with the boat. We can say it's from the times of Jesus. We can't prove that he was on it or not. We were in there. So you have to be very careful with that. But usually if you find something from that period, with this close enough, you can assume that, it's somehow relates to the person, but at least to what happened there.
What has been your favorite discovery of your career so far? I know you were saying
years. Oh, there are so many. I don't know what to choose. It's a bit like if you're in a room full of beautiful women, choose one. Impossible.
I would choose my wife, by the way, just in case she's listening.
You're scared. I don't get you in trouble now. But the thing is that if we talk already about King Solomon, that's also a fact. Why? Because there's one day my daughters that live all around the world, they came to visit and said, Father, we want to have a picnic with you on an island. We have a little islands in front of our house. Mm-hmm. Let's swim to an island and make a picnic like we did when we were small. Yeah. Okay? I said, great idea. And I straight away grabbed my snorkel and fins and said, no, without snorkeling equipment. We know if we take you to a picnic, you're going to look for antiquities again, and we have a picnic and you're not with us again. Okay, so I left the stuff home, and we went to the island. While swimming to the island, this is a small bay, and most of it you can wade through the water, but this area I have to swim also, because there was a big storm in the winter that deepened it out. And suddenly we took back and we see our dog. We got this golden retriever is following us. Mm-hmm. But he's already very old and not so strong. And we saw it start to get in trouble. So one of my daughters was closest to him. She turned around to help him to get back to shore. And she put her foot while she wanted to lift him. Because she waded through the water where the dog couldn't stand. And suddenly she sees that the dog is standing on something. So she tried to lift him up and put her foot on what he is standing on. And suddenly her foot goes in a big round hole. And she feels it's a stone. Well, she has seen me enough studying stone anchors. I said, Father, you got here the bloodiest, biggest stone anchor in the world. You better come whole leg went into it, you know. So actually, the dog discovered this biggest stone anchor in the world.
Did he get his picture in magazines and stuff?
Yes, I have brought some with me. You can see it. My picture is not even in it. It's Petal, the archaeological dog.
The dog discovered. Got the credit.
Find the Solomon Brexite. So, because after that, we found it and we retrieved it. We started digging underneath and then we found the Brexite, which date carbon dating. Exactly 3,000 years old. So it's from the times of King Solomon. I won't say it's a ship from that land of that time. Of course, a ship can be from a completely different country that accidentally sunk there in the times of King Solomon. But finally, we got wood. I brought some with me for some to show you. But actually, you got wood from the times of King Solomon. That in itself is already something. I mean, I have to admit, my dog was a better explorer than me. He found it.
Okay. Every dog will have his day. You know, I guess that's what we have to say.
So then, if you ask already about the major discoveries, there's another project that has kept me busy for 16 years until I finally found the Holy Grail of Napoleon days. Mm-hmm. One day on an old map, Shelley and me, we found out that that we found also accidentally in a rainy day in the storerooms of the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem, we found this old map from Jacques Cousteau. And it was written in that Napoleon, on this map, was in this place on 22 May 1799. And nobody knew about it. We went to all the experts. We asked him, what happened there? Why? What Napoleon? We know about Yafo, Akko, Tavo. What he did there? So we didn't know. Then slowly over the years, we collected material in the French archives and so on. About 47 letters of soldiers that they wrote home from that moment, diaries from generals, And they tell us about his Napoleon's army's retreat from Acre back to Egypt, and after they gave up the siege, and they came to the port that was their marine supply base for the siege of Acre, and they collected the 12,000 soldiers there again, and it turned out that the third of them were either wounded or ill with the plague and typhoid and whatever. So Napoleon was waiting for ships to take them back. Then he found out the ships were taken already by the British Admiral Sidney Smith, and he has no other way to walk with his terrible army all the way back to Egypt by foot. So he made a decision to dump all the armor, to jettison all the armor into the sea, and take the soldiers and sick with him. So what tells this to us? That you got all the armor of 12,000 soldiers in the bay, 12,000 rifles, scabbards, cannons, well, a whole list of bronze cannons, and that. Wow, this is maybe not for the Holy Land, but it's this is something for French history for sure.
Yeah.
So, but it took us 16 years of diving, we couldn't find everything. Anything was buried under the sand, layers of the... And only after storms, occasionally the sand moves and you can discover it. So only after 16 years, there was the revelation that the seabed opened up. And here are all the...
Wow.
So there was another major thing. But the greatest thing of all was, of course, the Galilee boat. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter where I go in the world lecturing everywhere. They only want to hear about one thing, and it's the Galilee boat.
The thing about the Jesus boat that I find kind of interesting is it was discovered back in the 80s, right?
86.
And now, it just now seems to be getting a lot of attention. I only heard about it just recently, and you know, now you're touring around and talking about it. And I was just kind of curious why the discrepancy in time from when it was discovered to now suddenly people are learning about it seemingly for the first time in the general public.
Okay. I think there are many reasons. First of all, we, the people who did the project, we are too busy with the next project, with the next project. Yeah. You know, to promote something, you need a completely different... It's another profession. You need other people for that. We are always in the field. So that's one of the things. Beside it, it was a very long story. It was not only the discovery, it was the excavation, and then 10 years of preservation, and it took 14 years until we finally got it where it was supposed to be, from a grave in a watery tomb until the exhibition in the... in the museum, Kibbutz Ginosar, Yigal Alon Museum. And so it was a long, long way. And we couldn't only dedicate ourselves to this project with all our own life going on and all the other projects and all of us and forth. Shelley even went to working in the States. So it was a long, long way to go. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, it became quite famous, maybe not so much here, but we even got the Pope over there in the year 2000, and we got... hundreds of thousands of pilgrims on the way in the meanwhile.
Right.
But we didn't have the time to travel around the world and
talk about it.
This came only now that we got these fantastic people here that decided to take the project of bringing the message to the world, the Jesus Boat Museum.com company, which involves also famous people from Israel, that started promoting of the project because it's... It's been too long already. We talked about 23 years.
That's a long time. Yeah, and we were.
But I won't say that people don't know. Wherever I go, they heard about it, like the Titanic, you know.
Yeah.
But they don't know that most of the pilgrims that come to Israel, they come to see it, and also to go with the pilgrim boats, the copies of it, the voyage over the lake. And that's it. But the promotion side has never been done as it is today. This is actually the first time that we go out and bring the Gospels instead of the people come to Israel.
Well, it's funny because I went to Israel in the late 90s and, you know, it wasn't a part of our tour or whatever. You know, we didn't get the chance to see it. And so just hearing about it now, I was like, man, I'm kind of bummed that I missed that when we were actually, because we're there at the Sea of Galilee and it seemed low key even in the late 90s.
Okay,
but don't forget that
for many years it was actually being cooked in a big big swimming pool.
Yeah.
So in a brownish material, you couldn't even see it. We were surprised actually when we pumped the stuff out after 10 years out of the pool that she was still there. I mean, she's been cooked by 70 degrees for so many 10 years.
Yeah.
So, but everything around this boat, not only the boat itself, that everything is a miracle, actually. Because
The way it was discovered was very unusual. That it wasn't found at a low tide, a low time.
Well, I'll tell you, when we got a message of the two fishermen brothers, Moshe and Yuvi Luvan, that they found wood and nails and coins, and maybe it's a ship, it can also be just a little chest with coins, but if they want us to come check it, as being the underwater archaeology inspectors, to the Department of Antiquities. So when I remember when we were driving up there, and when you go down in the valley, the Sea of Galilee, there is this note on the side of the road that tells you you're now entering, you're going under the sea level of the Mediterranean, right. You know, Mediterranean sea level. We start already joking. Yeah, if it's a boat, we're going to have the lowest excavation in the world. You know? The deepest that, and still on
dry land.
On dry land. Yeah. Even though in the beginning we're not sure if she's in the water or not, because we brought a whole jeep full with diving equipment. but of course, first of all, it's the miracle that there was a drought for 3 years, just like we are now in the moment. It's Israel's major water reservoir also. So it's life, actually, for us, this lake. And the natural mood goes up and down together with the level of the Sea of Galilee. Yeah. And so it was actually found in a fantastic way, because these guys were just walking on the seabed. They were usually have a 3 meter of water. So there's one thing. Then they accidentally found it. Then when we got here and they explained what they found, we didn't see it yet. We just had a coffee and said, okay, don't call us again every time you find a nail and a piece of wood. You know? look for this type of connections. Then we know it's ancient. Then it's worthwhile to come all the way from the Mediterranean. And that was the great thing that we went there and we asked them, where's the boat? And they say, you're standing on it. Mud. So we dig a little bit in the mud. And the first thing we find, there's these connections that we told them about. So that was already unbelievable. On the moment that we realized that we got here at least a 2,000 year old ship, suddenly pouring rain started after 3 years of drought.
Oh no!
Okay? And it was very hot, enormous amount of water. We all drenched, but we were dancing like Indians because we were so happy. You know? And suddenly it stopped, and we got this double rainbow exactly on the side. So, what more of miracles you want in the Sea of Galilee? So from that moment, we all realized, from this moment, our lives will never be the same. And if I see myself sitting here, now how much? 10,000 kilometers from that place.
Yeah, you're a little bit higher than you were there, that's for sure.
I see the life certainly changed after that, and for all of us. But, but the thing is, from that moment, everything became a roller coaster. Everything became unbelievable.
Well, explain what the significance of this find is, because, you know, some people might be saying it's a boat, big deal. Okay, maybe it's from the time of Jesus, but why is that such a significant find? And perhaps more importantly, why should Christians care that we found some boat in the mud? I mean, what is the significance of this? How does it apply to our lives?
Okay, I'll tell you another quick story.
Okay.
When I was a little boy in Holland, I went to Sunday school, you know, Bible teaching. But my buddies went fishing. And I never told this story to anyone. I was ashamed of it. But if you're already here, far away from home, I can do it. So I tried to one day to challenge God, you know, as a little boy, 7, 8 years old. I said, well, I'm not so sure there's this guy that knows everything, you know, this big power. And next Sunday, I go fishing instead of Sunday school. So I skipped Sunday school. And I went fishing with the boys in a little boat on the bank of one of the rivers there. And I felt great. Because you see, they didn't catch me. You see, I got away with it. And we had a good time. And suddenly was this voice, you know, not the voice of God, from the Sunday school teacher standing on the bank. Hey, you! in those days, I didn't realize I was some kind of Judas under my friends, but this she figured it out, and I was sure God sent her. You know? See, from that time, I was a believer. Anyway, she was a very clever person. I wish she could see us today, but she gave me punishment, and I had to write something about for the next Sunday about everything that's in the Bible about the Sea of Galilee and the boats.
Really? Wow.
So that was my first intriguing. There I got involved with the boats and fishermen of the Sea of Galilee. And I started collecting from all the pictures that exist about it. I made a really nice little work for it. I was really proud of it. Mm-hmm. And she in turn gave me later a big picture. It looks a bit like this from a boat in the Sea of Galilee mm-hmm. with this sunset. So kitschy that I just didn't agree with that. You know, I was always a little enfant terrible. So I did, sunsets like this. This is kitsch. This is, and I have to admit later I've seen them myself. But the thing is that we had an argument about it. I remember that. I'm ashamed of it now. But the, so we got very much, I got very much from the beginning involved with fishermen in the Sea of Galilee, that part of the Bible especially with it. I never could imagine, of course, that one day I would get so much involved in that. But I really understood once we found that boat site that the importance of it, it's Michelangelo, it's Dali, it's Rembrandt, it doesn't matter. All the great masters made at least one biblical scene as a scene from the boat in the Sea of Galilee. Hmm. Later, I start studying everywhere around the world. There's not a church in the world or a glass and lead window or a mosaic from 2,000 years ago that you don't find a picture of the the Galilee boat. Mm-hmm. So I understand in biblical history, in the hearts of the Christians, it's very important, just not less than the temple for the Jews in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Okay? Especially also when you come as a pilgrim, everything you imagine about the Holy Land, it's very hard to find the connection with it. Bethlehem is a refugee camp. Nazareth is in...
churches are built over everything.
Everything. Everything. Traffic jams in Nazareth instead of green alleys. And, but the only thing that the peace is still there, and is like most people imagine it, you know, the pastoral views, the silence, the beauty, is the Sea of Galilee. Mm-hmm. So, and with it, of course, come the boats and everything connected with Jesus, the boats, the fishermen, and things like that. So, people have been looking for hundreds of years for a boat in the Sea of Galilee and never found one. We also, we've been diving a lot in the Sea of Galilee, a lot, many times, and we, but it's impossible because unlike the Mediterranean or other seas, there's a mud bottom and the mud all the time stirs up, and if you dive even more, and there's no view at all. You have to tie yourself to the divers. You get lost, stuck in a fishing net or that. So we found cars. We found Kalashnikovs. We found all kinds of stuff, but nothing connecting us to Jesus. At least, okay?
Because Jesus didn't drive a car.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Could be a good thing. But okay, we actually gave up on one time. I remember I had all these maps of the Sea of Galilee, and somebody wanted them very much. One day I donated to them and said, "Oh, take them all, because we won't dive there anymore." Okay? That was all off territory. And So it became even more surprised with that. Now, we could have found any boat from any period, but we find only one exactly from the times of Jesus, by the carbon dating, by the oil lamps, by the cooking pots, everything involved in the boat. So we got something, some little window. You can't prove that Jesus was on the boat, made it even as a carpenter.
Right.
We can't prove that. We weren't there. There's no scientific proof about that. But all we can say, it's from the time and from that place, and the only thing we got. So that's the closest you can get.
You know, a lot of Christians, especially in our day and age, kind of stay away from the intellectualism side of stuff. We like to go, we like to get a nice little message that makes us feel good, and we go home. Mm-hmm. And yet, some of the best things that can bolster our faith, encourage us as Christians, come from the realm of archaeology and science and these areas that a lot of, well, I'm not smart enough to understand that. How important do you think it is for Christians to get excited about archaeology? We got a guy here in Albuquerque, you know, who's excavating Sodom and Gomorrah and saying, you know, I read in the Bible where Sodom and Gomorrah is supposed to be. I went there, we dug, we found where it was supposed to be. And I think a lot of times there's a disconnect between what's happening in the world of biblical archaeology and what people know about it in the church. How can we connect it more so that Christians realize there is tangible evidence for what the Bible talks about and that the Bible is historically reliable?
Okay, I understand. And that's why I also am more in the popular archaeology these days, because I also found that the scientific side is completely disconnected with the people at large. And actually, it's supposed to be a science for everybody. And to we have the honor to discover these things, but we should bring this information to the general public.
Because it helps us as well.
It helps us, of course. Yeah. It helps us also, because we're not doing it just for nothing. But the thing is that we need each other in that. But of course, we not go out in the field only to prove somebody's religion or somebody. Right. Right? In the course of it, we must be as honest as possible and things like that. So, like last week with the same fisherman brothers, we went to Bechida, the place where five of the fishermen apostles came from. And actually, they were just excavating there and they found a fisherman's house. With fishing hooks and stone anchors, and so you can't say that's from exactly the house of Peter,
right? Right.
But it's from that time. It's that place. It's one of those fishermen houses. So this is the closest you can get. So where we were sitting there on the floor in half a circle and discussing it and eating bread and drinking water.
Cool.
I mean, it's cool.
Yeah.
When I went out with Moshele that night fishing on the Sea of Galilee, and with all the stories in my mind, the biblical stories, and with the silence of the night and then the moonlight, you don't need anything more. You live the Bible. If people were asking me which church you belong to, I said, I live in the Church of Israel. I mean, I live in the middle of biblical history.
Yeah.
I touch the stones every day. And so it's just magic. I mean, then that morning when that I discovered that it's not the sunset that makes it so red, it's sunrise. I mean, for me, it was the thing I was waiting up since my childhood.
Yeah.
I mean, it became electrifying. It's really magic. So, and with this boat, everything was magic. It's not only the discovery and the way we preserved it, but we had no means at all. Now, you try to do an excavation of a boat 2,000 years old, which can't even hold its own weight with this like wet carton.
Right.
Okay. And how you take a boat like this without it disintegrates, how you remove it, how you preserve it, all these things, they're millions of dollars. We had no zero budget at all. We are just two fishermen, two archaeologists, five buckets, two shovels, and do an excavation. I mean, so that all the people joined in from every religion, from, you know, and ambassadors and clergymen and whatever you want, and especially the kibbutz there. It became unbelievable. I mean, we didn't send out any message. It all happened just naturally. That's something in itself. That we managed to do it in 10 years, while the other wreck we took out of the sea and preserved in Israel took 5 years. I mean, that says enough. It's a Guinness World of Record. Then we overcame every difficulty just with cool means, just with things nobody would even think of. Say, for example, when we needed tags to put on, we use cactus needles. They're cheapest. I mean, the same. When we said we need stainless steel needles, where we buy them, we have no time, we have no money. And this fisherman comes by and said, give me scissors. So he cut all the cactus needles off the Sabra cactus and we use those. I mean, that's another thing. You know?
Wow.
And that's I wrote some article about the boat. They called it Moses and the goldfish. I mean, you know, what's Moses and the goldfish? At one point when the boat was in a pool, the preservation pool in Sweetwater, suddenly became infested full with worms.
Yeah.
They were, we're talking about Jurassic Park here, you know. These were eggs that were 2,000 years preserved in the mud. And now in the contact with the air and the light, they became alive again. So
wow.
how we get rid of Jurassic Park. So, we doctors, professors, we didn't know how to tackle this problem. Again, it's the same Moshe fisherman standing in the corner. I don't know if you ever finished high school either. You guys, scientists, you don't know anything about life, you know. I will take care of that one. And the next morning came with two buckets with goldfish, put them in the water, and it saved the boat. I mean,
wow.
So everything connected with this boat, you know, how the American ambassador suddenly came up and brought the experts from here, from the States, to help us in it. And took care of the preservation material from Dow Industries and things like that. So everything came naturally. Everything was one big miracle. You can't do an excavation like this if you have not $1 million, if you don't have a 40-man professional crew. We were all new in digging ships from mud, and we never had taken one out. So we're all pioneers in a way, you know. And everything worked out. And in the end, even the Pope came to visit. So, I mean, in the year 2000. So it became one of the great attractions for the pilgrims in those days. So everything connected with this boat, it's unbelievable. It's one big miracle boat. It's one big... If you say she's beautiful, when... When I asked the expert, Dick Steffi, in those days, who came to help us, and I said, no, after 2 days that he studied and won't say a word. I said, no, that was a good carpenter. What do you think? Well, I know who made this boat. He said, well, I was waiting to hear. Jesus made it himself. And when he said, yeah. Well, it was Frankenstein, actually. It looks terrible. The guy didn't know what he was doing. Yeah. So there was a disappointment.
Wow.
But and now, 20 years later, I have to say, wow, this guy was really good. I mean, to make from good materials something reasonable,
mm-hmm.
every carpenter can. But take from just little pieces. You know, make a boat that also floats and keeps floating for, we estimate, about 60 years.
Yeah.
That was a really good carpenter because not one plank is normal. Everything is from little pieces like that, and used material and things like that. So this is a very, very special boat, and everything was special with it. The discovery, the excavation, the miracles surrounding it, with everything that happened on the way. And it doesn't stop. Everything, it's changed all our lives. One of the fishermen became an artist, and
really?
And they have now meetings every year to bring Arabs and Jews together and create art there on the same banks where the boat was found.
Really?
And
wow.
Made a whole park about it. Then there was, of course, created the Yigal Alon Museum, of course, from the same place that we delivered the boat after 2,000 years. It was also delivered Israel. After bondage, after 2,000 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the leaders in that process was, of course, Yigal Alon,
mm-hmm.
after which also the museum is dedicated. And his idea of living together, Arabs and Jews. And that's, of course, a very important message that has to be brought. And the boat became one of the exhibits in that beautiful museum.
Mm.
Okay, and the people involved also actually his daughter is one of the people today promoting this boat here in America.
Very cool.
And her husband, who's sitting here beside us, but they also found it's time the world hear about it. They,
yeah.
A lot in this region, and also realized it can't be that so few people know still about it after 20 years.
Well, what are you working on now? It's a big project, but I'm assuming that your career in archaeology didn't end with the Jesus boat. What are some of the new things that you're working on? What are some of the new hunts that you're on? What new clues have you discovered that are leading you off into a new adventure?
Well, the Sea of Galilee will always be the biggest, and it keeps on going, as you see, even on the budget. But since then, I've dug 28 other boats.
Wow.
And worked on 28 boats, but half of them we finished. I'm a scientist of Haifa University's days, and with Jaka Hanhoff and with Chris Brandon from England. Every year we excavate about 2 wrecks. Usually I find them in the winter times. In the summer times we...
This is all in the Mediterranean?
It's all in the Mediterranean, yeah. And so we keep on excavating, but nothing that... even that both that wreck site from the times of King Solomon didn't get known so much about the world.
Yeah.
If somebody heard about it, because of the dog. But
The dog's more famous than the discovery.
We're busy scientifically there. We write books about it. And movies, I create part of at least 3 to 5 movies every year. So I'm also producing many of them myself. But the Natural Geographic Discovery, we're enough in that field in the moment also. But the major find that on the moment has my interest is a wreck not so old, but it's complete. With the masts, with the pipe of the captain, and the whistle of the boatsman.
Really?
And hundreds of crates in it with beautiful glass goblets and whatever you want. And hundreds of pottery. I think it turns out it came from the coast of France. And it crashed on the shore about 1600. So it's not that old, actually. But because it's so complete, and we can trace exactly from which ovens in France, from which village came where the pots were created. So we got here a beautiful story going on at the moment also, which will be in the end of the film also. But I call it wrecked in the Holy Land, you know. It could be also the boat from Alfonso. There was a Christian from that's also wrecked in the same place in that time. who brought crosses from Jerusalem for the churches in Europe, and beads, you know, praying beads, and chests full of them, as is written. And he left Jaffa with a storm, pushed the ship back, and it crashed on the shore exactly in Dor. In that, so it can also be that place. But then we just have to dig around it, because the Arabs later threw all the crosses overboard, of course. For them, it was a bad thing. And so if we dig around and we find these crosses, we know it's the boat from Alphonse. So we're still in the process, but it's a really intriguing excavation at the moment. Well, the university does many, also in Akko, in Atlit, and in Turkey, we're excavating things everywhere. But this is my major thing at the moment, and looking for more rest. We found just a Byzantine ship, another Christian ship, full with a cargo of marble. Maybe it's even a church, that you know, the prefabricated church that you have to put back with crosses on it. We've been digging from the Christian side also a hole. I found a whole church, which turned out to be later also a basilica of 1,000 square meters in Dor, which we excavated already in the 70s with Claudine Dauphin, including a tomb of a bishop. And one of the beautiful finds we found lately in that wreck that came from Europe, we opened one of the crates and there was a book. It's beautifully preserved.
Really?
And the first words that I see written there, it's to believe and to trust and to... to sacrifice, okay? Uh-huh. So what's more beautiful than that? The message of life just underwater. You're just there with you, alone with yourself, breathing air in the water, and you discover this book, and it's the first words you see. The message of life. You have to trust, you have to believe, and you have to sacrifice. So this is that. And another round Shelley found there a few years ago was written on it. After all, God will pass the last judgment. I mean, it's... Can't be beautiful. I found this beautiful scale in the water with crosses on it, and also Byzantine. And it's written, Jesus Christ, our Savior, you know, please protect our boat and crew. I mean, it didn't help. They sunk. They were there. But it's fantastic. Every time you have this little lead to Christianity, to your past.
It's interesting how prevalent it was in all those cultures that, you know, even if people weren't necessarily Christian, they had been touched by the Christian movement in some way, even that far back. Could you explain to people a little bit about what it's like to dive into the water and find a wreck? You know, can you relate a little bit of what that experience is like? Give people like a mental picture of what it's like to go looking under the water for shipwrecks?
Yeah, of course, first of all, I have to admit that we really spoiled. I mean, most people and even professionals, they hope once in their lifetime to find a wreck.
Yeah.
And we found dozens of them, if not hundreds of wreck sites over here. So in that case, we are really spoiled. So I don't know if the feeling I get today when I find another one is the same like somebody will find the first one. But I'm sure I remember something from the first time that I found it. I've been walking beside my shoes for years since after. But the thing is that that wow feeling, of course, it's immense. Just diving itself. First of all, it's a good profession. Mm. I mean, in salt water, it's good for your skin. You don't have to bite from the Dead Sea.
Yeah,
you
know? That's right.
And it's underwater, so it's every time you're going back, like in the belly of your mother, you know, you're floating in the water, it's relaxing. It's very healthy also. I'm not so sure about the quality of the water, the pollution these days, but that's okay. And there are no cell phones in the water. That helps also.
People can't reach you there.
So we are really good in the water to hide ourselves. So while they're busy with our work, in which we can do everything today, if it's, you know, we measure, we photograph, we video film, besides eating, you can do everything in the water these days. But so it's a very good working place, that's for sure. But for the rest, it's just a hard day. It's a hard job because it's not only the nice summer days. We dig those wrecks in September, October. By the way, for the listeners, everyone that knows to dive can come and join. Okay, that's no problem. That's an important thing.
I can think of a few people who'd be excited about that.
We have a whole volunteer program. Most of our divers are volunteers coming from all around the world, usually in September, October. We have about 6 weeks that we, at least two wrecks a year we excavate. It's a big expedition. And it's really, there's not many occasions that you have, that you can participate in a thing like this in the world,
right.
And certainly in 2-3 meters of water, and beautiful water, warm water, clear water, and barbecue on the beach.
Yeah.
That's a good university.
Hey,
you see?
That's the kind of university I wish I would have gone to.
So this is a good thing. But on the other side, you don't see, when we are looking for those wreck and we discover them, it's usually in the wintertime. So the water is cold, the water is choppy, there are lots of pirates out there, so we go already very early in the water in the morning when the sea is not quite exactly to be the first, and then it's no fun, of course. It's fighting the elements, it's cold water, and it's winter. But then you find these things, because the Mediterranean has all this sand from Egypt, our coast, dunes up till 8 meters, and everything is buried in it. That's why it's also beautifully preserved, because there's no air coming to those wrecks. An anaerobic situation. So they're beautifully preserved. The ropes, the woods, the cheese and the jars, everything is beautifully preserved. We had this project with Napoleon I started to tell about before. It took me 16 years. And every time I look out my window and watch the sea, it's under there, it's under there, I can't find it. And also again, this one day with... together with Orna Cohen, the same girl that did later the preservation of the boat. And we owe all our honor to her also. Don't forget Shelley and Orna, besides the brothers, they're also key players in this whole thing. And then it's just that one day that I felt today's the day. Tomorrow that we're going to find it. And we were working in Akko in those days. So I put out the flag in the morning by our base, and everybody asked, why is the flag? I said, today we're going to find the Napoleon stuff. And I had this beautiful dream last night. Oh, come on, you with your fantasies. So we went in Akko, we came back, I said, well, I'm going to look for it. I said, oh, come on, 16 years, not today's day. We couldn't even find a button up till now. You know? So we go out there, and Orna and me with the boat, we had a Zodiac in those days, and I said, okay, anchor. She throws out the anchor, we jump overboard. We couldn't believe it. The whole sea bit, the cannons, the rifles.
Awesome.
So there's some hand guiding us, that's for sure. I'm convinced about that, because as I told you before, we're really spoiled. I mean, there's not a thing we didn't find yet. I mean, I once had a wish list, you know.
Yeah.
Except not finding a Phoenician boat or... we found everything we could imagine so far. But it's a fantastic feeling. I know. I always said, if those cannons from Napoleon, I had only daughters, so I always called it my sons. You know, it was a glowing feeling. That was unbelievable. But again, nothing got the feeling that we had with the Galilee boat. Because we realized very well, this changed our lives also. Besides that, we got here something good. Actually, it doesn't have a cargo. We always out for those cargoes. About, you know? And there can be ballast stones, there can be gold. But this boat is empty. But the spiritual carry, this emotional cargo, which I usually call it, that it has, that touches so many people in the world. You know, there are people that are asked to touch us because we touch the boat. I mean, how far can we get? I mean,
really?
I mean,
I won't be asking that, just in case you care.
But the thing is that I understand this. We found out this boat has a complete different meaning. For so many people in the world, than only the science that we read out of it, the scientific material.
People connect with it in a very unique way.
And you know, it's very funny. When we're working in the preservation pool in those days, and this was this glass gallery, and all the visitors in the meantime, they passed. You should see how people were crying, how people got emotionally involved.
Really?
You got Italian people, they start singing and crying. You know?
Really?
You got Japanese, they shoot everyone 20 rolls of film. You know? And the guy got the Israeli people from Tel Aviv said, whoa, that's all, where are the masks? Where are the cannon? Where are the
That's awesome. One last thing I wanted to ask. I know you've heard about, or I don't know if you've heard, but there's some people who think that they can still find Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat. How I don't know if you keep up with what other people are doing in the world of archaeology.
Sure.
How likely do you think it is that someone will be able to find Noah's Ark up there on Mount Ararat? Is it possible? Is it probable?
Well, I know that one of the best people in our field, Bob Ballard, who found also the Titanic and things like that, mm-hmm. he is looking for it in the
right.
Black Sea, for example.
Yeah.
Many years ago, I was involved in it with one of the astronauts here from NASA, one of the famous who became very religious, also started looking for it and invited me to get there because they found on Mount Ararat, they found the same stone anchors that I find in the Mediterranean, and so that way we get also involved in it. There are websites, if you have to believe them. They found it already many years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
But the search goes on, and I don't know. I learned to keep an open mind.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's good.
Even Paul, if you talk about Apostle Paul, which I was never involved in until last winter when I found a painting in Holland and some friends bike shed in the garden a 2 by 2 square meter painting. And I straight away realized it's Apostle Paul leaving Caesarea on his way to be beheaded in Rome. And you see the Carmel also, everything. It's no good. And after we studied this winter with experts all around the world, it turned about a 16th century painting, and it's worth millions and billions. But the thing is that there was another great discovery. But why I'm telling this story? Because yesterday in the airplane, I take a piece of a newspaper. I see suddenly that they found a tomb in Rome,
mm-hmm.
and they found a skeleton, and supposed
shards.
To be from Paul.
From Paul,
and tunic. And carbon-14 dated exactly 2,000 years.
Yep.
So where I go now the last few days and talk with people about it, they tell me, yeah, like with the book, maybe yes, maybe no.
Yeah.
So again, this fisherman Moshele, I phoned him last night, and I tell him, listen, you heard the great news about Paul. I said, oh, no, I didn't hear. But so I said, yeah, but we can't prove, of course, it's him or not. And I said, well, it's very easy. Again, the same cool fisherman, not scientific at all. He said, well, is the head still on this? It isn't. I mean, you know, so science won't always give the answer. It also a cool mind.
That fisherman sounds like a good guy to have around. He seems to provide a lot of solutions.
He became a new brother. Yeah. But after all, he became a fisherman of men.
Well, that's good.
Because he became his life changed also.
Well, we're talking with Kurt Revay. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and hanging out with us on Raw Talk, talking about the Jesus boat and how you discovered that. And real quick, do you have a website if people want to find out more about you, like those volunteer opportunities that you're talking about to help with excavations? Where can they find out more about you and get in touch with what you're doing?
Okay, our website is being renewed in a moment, but at least my visiting card is on aquadora.com,
mm-hmm.
a Northern Wind tourism site. Northernwind.com. Also, they can find get to reach me and find out what other kinds, the diving and so on, what we're doing. And of course, the JesusBoat.com site will tell everybody about the thing about the boat, and people will also be in contact with us.
All right. Okay? Well, thank you very much.
Everybody's
Kurt.
Invited on Wednesday evening, right? We have this big
when you're
event.
Going to show some of those clips and everything.
All right.
That'll be a lot of fun.
Then we can see what we here right now.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right.
It's enjoyable.
And that's going to wrap things up for Raw Talk this week, and I hope you got a lot out of it. That was I always love talking about biblical archaeology, one of the things I enjoy following as a very amateurish amateur. And I hope you guys enjoy the rest of your 4th of July weekend. We'll see you again next week for Raw Talk.
Thanks for joining us on Raw Talk on M88. Get the podcast of tonight's show free at m88.org. And join us again next week for more Raw Talk on M88.